Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Good afternoon, my friends, fiends and ghouls. This is Alan Abrol. Welcome to Agitators Anonymous podcast, coming to you out of Dublin, the Republic of Ireland, on the weekend of St. Patrick's Day. Don't forget, when you're out there getting pissed, getting leery, getting difficult and problematic in your local bar, the moment you put on a little green hat or a ginger beard, that is cultural appropriation, my friends, and I am not impressed. Let me say those two words one more time. Ginger beard. Anyway, what are we going to talk about today? Today I'm going to talk about musicians. Why musicians die young. That great Black Sabbath song, the opening track of Heaven and Hell, if I'm not mistaken. Dying young. Why do so many musicians die young? I'm going to look at the reasons why. Being a traditional musician or an analog musician in the old sense, why that shaves a couple of years off your life. All the reasons why. And it's, some of it is more mundane than you imagine. Some of it is not just sex, drugs and rock and roll. Some of it is, well, listen and you'll find out. The podcast, as ever, is sponsored by Metal Blade Records. You can use the promo code AA2024. That is the year we are in, allegedly. Or if you're one of those people who don't believe that the Dark Age has actually happened, I think we're in the year 1724 or something. Isn't that true? Have you heard about this theory? Some people believe, because an awful lot of historical record just disappears around about the middle of the 9th century and reemerges just before the Enlightenment, I think, in the 13th century. They think that 300 years is just missing from the calendar, or was just added on. I don't know more than that, but that makes me an expert. Of course it does. Anyway, as I said, follow the links underneath. You can go to indiemerch.com/metalbladerecords. I promised you an Elusive God track that is coming next Tuesday. To you, an entire track of this really good new doom band from Croatia, who you're going to hear a little bit underneath this before I get into the subject of why. Why do musicians die early? And I'm not just talking about metal musicians. Just a quick search. We have Kurt Cobain, Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, Buddy Holly, Amy Winehouse, Jim Morrison, Duane Allman, Robert Johnson, Brian Jones, Tupac Shakur, Otis Redding, Hank Williams, Richie Valens, Ronnie Van Zant, Sam Cooke, Selena, whoever that is, Bob Marley, Freddie Mercury, Ian Curtis, John Lennon, Patsy Cline. The number is just insane. Of how many musicians. And I'm not even going to start. Well, I suppose, seeing as it's a heavy metal podcast, I should have thought about this, but it's so many musicians. So many metal musicians have been clocking out. From Paul Baloff to Pete Steele to my friend Selim Lamucci, John Neuwirth, Jill Janus, Dimebag, Eddie Van Halen, Riley Gale, Cliff Burton, Per Olin, Randy Rhodes, Jeff Hanneman, Trevor Starnad, Chuck Schuldiner, Robin Crosby, and on and on and on. You fill in the blanks with all the ones that you know. There's just so many, it's crazy. So there was a study done, I think it was about a decade ago. So I presume in that decade, as I've often talked about on the podcast, this is the decade of social media derangement, that some of the statistics have altered a little bit into what's considered a musician compared to what once was a musician. Obviously, a punk rock musician in 1981, let's say the bass player of Black Flag is slightly different than a TikTok influencer musician in 2021. You're putting yourself at far less risk being one to the other. And some of those reasons are very mundane. But let's take a look at some of them. So I guess some people would call this tempting fate. Tempting fate. But let's discuss why musicians die earlier than most. And if this is my last will and podcasting testament, no, you can't have my Manowar vinyls. Have you heard of the 27 Club? The 27 Club is something like an informal list of popular musicians, actors, artists, and other celebrities who have died at 27. I think the claims of some sort of spike at 27 is kind of unidentified mumbo jumbo, but there's something to it. It seems to be a certain age where obviously you've come out of the teenage years, the early 20-something years, and 27 is kind of the cusp of, hey, it's time to grow up now, time to grow up. And you know, even though I'm talking about musicians, I'm also talking about, I suppose, celebrities to some degree and actors as well. But let's try and narrow it down to musicians in the entertainment industry. But like I said, the 27 Club, Brian Jones, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, who art on high, I've said thy name wrong. Jim Morrison. And like I said, you can throw Kurt Cobain in as there as well. The British Medical Journal, no less, stated in December 2011, they concluded that there was no risk, no increase in the risk of death for musicians at the age of 27, that this is just a kind of magical number. But the risks increased a little bit between the ages of 25 and 32, but the study noted that young adult musicians have a higher death rate than the general young adult population, surmising that fame, and I put that in inverted commas, fame may increase the risk of death among musicians, but this risk is not limited to age 27. But as they grow older, this risk increases. A 2014 article at The Conversation, God, who names your magazine, your periodical, The Conversation, suggested that statistical evidence shows popular musicians are most likely to die at the age of 56. Doesn't seem like much. Seems like that's the equivalent of living your whole life in Glasgow, isn't that right? And having just been in Glasgow and played in Glasgow, and during a little technical hitch in the gig, I pointed out to the crowd, there's the bar. You may be unfamiliar with its environs, but imbibe at your leisure. I'm sure you know how. Was met with some howls of derision and some fuck you. But the Understanding Glasgow, the Glasgow Indicators Project, which is a study, it says that the Glasgow city has the lowest male healthy life expectancy at birth, which equals 56 years, and this is the lowest in the United Kingdom and Ireland, which is absolutely insane, because most other places around the world, it's usually about 70, 72. You remember that from your COVID experiment, that 72 years of age was the average life expectancy. Which is insane that somehow this suggests that living in Glasgow City for your whole life can shave 16 years off your life. But their studies would seem to correlate. And I know the science is hazy, but you learned that lesson already, right? I know the science is hazy, but it would seem to suggest that being a traveling, touring, hardworking musician could take up to 16 years off your life. So let's look at why. Are the days of rock and roll madness, are they a distant thing of the past? Who represents rock and roll danger anymore? Certainly ain't white dudes with guitars, that's for sure. But I digress. A little sidebar that might be worth a podcast in itself. Once again, what I mean by that is that the nature of being a rock and roll musician or being a musician has changed, and that the state of Johnny Thunders in 1980, I'm not sure you're going to find that equivalent now in them, or weren't 40 years later. You might somewhere, but things have changed. Young people have changed. Their aspirations have changed. The way they look at these things have changed. But that doesn't alter the fact that there is a band. Maybe you're sitting there right now listening to me, sitting in the back of a cramped tiny van on your way around Europe. And God bless all who travel in you. Sorry, Satan bless all who travel in you, my friends. I've been there for many, many years, over many, many times. But the point is, you don't have to be that famous to die in the back of a van on a highway somewhere in the lowlands, as I can attest to, as maybe you listened to the podcast I did at the time. But having escaped a high-speed crash in exactly those circumstances just about, was it 2 years ago, on our way from a festival in Belgium, I think Dour Festival or something like this, to a Graveland Festival in Holland, we experienced with Primordial a high-speed crash in exactly those circumstances. Could have been another rock and roll casualty. Vaguely well-known singer from Midling, yet aging into obscurity, pagan, or was it black metal? Not sure. Maybe black doom, pagan band Primordial. Also third-tier podcaster, clocks out after being crushed by an onrushing truck as he was involved in a high-speed crash. The woman who caused the crash, the old woman in front of us who caused the crash, was asked for comment, and she said that she saw a rat crossing the highway. Well, if there isn't a more heavy metal way to go than rat giving his life because of rat crossing highway, I do not know. But anyway, this woman said she braked as she saw a rat crossing the highway. But we live to tell the tale. A last-minute intervention by our driver, who literally skidded in to hit the car sideways instead of full-on at about 130 kilometres at about 7 in the morning, basically, I think, saved some of our lives. And certainly if the two guys at the front and the front right of the van weren't wearing their seatbelts, they would have been flung 30, 40 yards through the windscreen. And true enough, as I'm not joking, this woman literally just stopped dead in the middle of the motorway. Now, it was early enough that there weren't huge articulated trucks powering up outside the outward lane, but as we were spun into the outward lane, if one was coming along, it literally would have just ploughed into us and crushed us. And I was sitting in the back, and true enough, you would be without this podcast, or you might be listening to this podcast in hell or in heaven or whatever you want to say. But we did live to tell the tale. But let's say this, many didn't. And so let's start with one of the least rock and roll ways to go. And I've been in this scenario, as I said, many times in many continents. You arrive in the venue after a 10 to 14 hour drive, load in, play the show, and have to be back on the road at 4 a.m. in order to make the next show. Not just tours I've played on, but worked on as well. And this especially happens in the USA. And the driver needs some sleep, of course, but only has 4 hours to do so. And if you've been driving for 12 hours, so just go flick, clip, flick off and just sleep for like 6, 7, 8 hours is very, very difficult. That's why most drivers on bigger tours have, they have like a tachyograph, I think it's called. Oh no, a tachyograph is what you put in your throat, isn't it? Tracheotomy? I'm not sure. A tachyograph is what I remember it as. And this is a thing that has that, that marks off how long you've been driving as a driver. You can't do more than 8 hours. But of course, you're in the back of a van and you have to get from one end of a country to another. I remember driving all the way from one end of Poland to the other to make a show with Dread Sovereign. You get there, there's 35 people, and you think to yourself, fucking hell, we drove for 17 hours to get here. And you ask, do you dare to take the truck stop speed pills? I remember being in the USA, driving across the USA, and you would buy these pills in truck stops in the middle of America, and they were amazing because you would pick one with an angry animal on it. It had a shark or a hornet, my favorite one. Was a hornet. Hornet or a shark or a rhino or something like this. And we would have kind of wars of taking one or two at a time of each one and see how jittery it would make us, how you couldn't even keep your arms straight and all that kind of stuff. But you know, these are the kind of thing that young men do for shits and giggles. But the truth is that they're the kind of thing that keep you going, but also the kind of thing that stop you sleeping when you get to a place. And the tour booker, sometimes it seems, has simply thrown darts at a map and committed you all to a 10-hour plus drive in a van. And usually with one van driver who's also doubling, sometimes as the merch person, who's doubling maybe as the front of house. There isn't always an extra person to take over halfway through. And musicians generally, after playing, don't want to drive a van. And especially if you're from Ireland, you're on the opposite side of the road. So getting from A to B in a hurry is the cause of a ton of accidents. If you've ever read the harrowing Baroness story, Baroness, a band I love a lot, the story of how they crashed, I think, in the UK, and they literally went off the side of an overpass, and the guy was saying they were literally in mid-air, and he could just see air, and they went over, and then they slowly just, you know, well, obviously not slowly, but the van just stopped and then just fell. And they all went, you know, crashed up to the ceiling like something out of a movie. And I think two guys left the band after that. You've heard my account of the crash, which could have been much, much worse. But we've all, I think all bands have been in variations of this theme. When we got to the Graveland Festival, we met our friends from Tribulation, the Great Tribulation. And Adam told me a story that they crashed. I think it was either with Enforcer or Tribulation. And they were in the snow and they crashed into the back of a snowmobile. And he just pulled his legs up in time before the whole front end of the van was smashed. And he would have lost his legs if he hadn't. If he'd been asleep, he would have lost his legs. Let's say this. You all know the example of Lynyrd Skynyrd. I mean, this is an insane example. Okay, I get it. They're in a plane and not a van. And a van is a much more dangerous way to travel. But I'll give you that example. But it's true. And one of the reasons why this makes sense is because the more you travel, the more you move, the more likely you are to end up in a crumpled mess at the side of a road, the more you take risks, and the longer that journey and the more tired you are, the greater the coefficients, the more the Reaper smiles, tempting fate, eh? As a note of caution, just before I get into the incredible Lynyrd Skynyrd story, I would say if anybody wants some advice as a band, don't always agree to that huge drive. I've done it before where I've gone, nah, man, you know what? We got to arrive safely. We don't need to leave this early. Or take the train. The train is a really great alternative. I find it's much more fun and much more relaxing. Okay, a couple of changes, but some people don't like it, but the train is way better. But try and split the driving. If you are the driver, get the head down and try and sleep when you get to the venue. Don't hang out to wind down and get caught up in the evening unfolding. And then all of a sudden you have two beers in and you want to hang out and have chats. Disappear as quickly as possible and always book the driver a separate room. As a band, take a look at what time you land at. How long is the drive to the festival? This might mean the driver sent to get you has had no sleep. I've had that before. I've come out into an airport car park and watched a driver literally rise up like, out of a crypt and just pop their head up because they've got there an hour before and they've just been asleep for 45 minutes. And you think to yourself, fucking hell, this is dangerous. Because they have to get there in the first place. They didn't just arrive in the car park. As a promoter, take some consideration of the distances. Wasn't lockdown a great blessing to keep us safe? Oh, if only it had continued and all of these things, all of these terrible negative circumstances were negated for the rest of our lives. Well, anyway, the podcast is called Agitators Anonymous. What do you want? But it is true that to get from A to B, which could be just to make the gas money, just to sell a few t-shirts to make it practical, you end up putting yourself in danger. I'm not here to give lectures, but you really need to think about some of these things. And also sometimes somebody in the band has to step up for 2 hours and just change the driver. And I would also recommend this, and I did this many times with Daniel from Killtown. I took it upon myself to be the guy who sat up front and talked to him early in the morning and late at night. Put on music to put every cunt to sleep. I'm not a man who can just sleep easy and just put his head against the window and drift off. That's not who I am. The off switch in me is broken, as you probably know if you've been following the podcast. But I recommend pick one guy, pick one girl, pick one whoever to sit up the front and just chat to the driver to keep them alert. Because I remember being in on a motorway in Germany and some guy collecting us and watching him from the back. I was watching him in the mirror and he just started to nod off and fall asleep. And he was literally driving us at about 100 kilometers an hour and he fell asleep. And I had to literally climb from the back over two sets of, everyone's sleeping, going, oh, what are you doing? And not just like wake him up so as that he would, whoa, to either side. You know what I mean? I just did a cartoon motion with a steering wheel. But just to like sit in beside him and just kind of go, clap, clap, hey, dude. And then stop and go. And you go, I'm fine. Because, he's been paid and he to go from A to B or whatever. And you're about to miss a flight and you go, you know what? Let's just stop. And it's better we get there in one piece than dying on the way to try and make a flight. You can always stop at the next town and take a train. Maybe I recommend the train. The golden age of steam travel. No, I'm actually a train. I won't say a train enthusiast, but I certainly really do much prefer taking the train to being in a cramped van with a tired driver. Right then. So the Lynyrd Skynyrd story. In 1977, October the 20th, a small passenger aircraft ran out of fuel and crashed in a wooded area near Gillsburg, Mississippi of the USA. And it contained, it was chartered by the band Lynyrd Skynyrd, flying from Greenville, South Carolina to Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And it was crashed, and it crashed near its destination. The plane simply ran out of fuel near the end of the flight. upon realizing that the plane had insufficient fuel, the pilots attempted to navigate to Makum Airport, about 10 miles northeast of the eventual crash site. I'm reading from the Wikipedia here, actually looking at it. There was a documentary made a couple of years ago that I think the band did all they could to try and stop being produced, that managed to get made, but I haven't seen it, and it seems to be quite hard to find. But anyway, as a last resort, they attempted an emergency landing in an open field from where the plane eventually went down. Skimmed about 100 yards along the top of the tree line before smashing into a large tree and splitting the plane into pieces. So Van Zandt, guitarist vocalist Steve Gaines, backing vocalist Cassie Gaines, assistant road manager Dean Kilpatrick, Captain McCreary and First Officer William John Gray all died in the crash. And the survivors had been at the back of the plane. Apparently this plane, you know, was being chartered out to, or at least offered to, quite a few bands at the time. One of those was Aerosmith, who at this time were doing the Draw the Line tour, but they had, or rather their crew had rejected it because they felt that neither the plane nor the crew were up to standard. And when they'd gone to you know, check out the plane, they'd observed that the two of the pilots who were flying the plane were just like swigging a bottle of Jack between them, going, yeah, check out the plane, it's over there. And they were just sat in their little hut, just literally drinking Jack Daniels. And they kind of went, eh, maybe not, maybe we don't use this one. There's all this mythology around the crash as well, where I think some of the backing singers wouldn't take the plane. They felt it was too risky. Other people had dreamt of the crash and warned against the band taking it. All sorts of mythology surrounds this infamous accident. One of the survivors, Artemis Pyle, some name that, this is a quote from him about the crash. The right engine was consuming a lot of fuel and we were cramping back and forth. You're on the same axis, but the right engine is pulling, not running as rich as the left. We knew after the fire shut out of the right engine, we had a problem. But we thought surely our pilots would land at the closest airport and get us off the plane to refuel, but they didn't. They made several fatal decisions. They should never have taken off. We were morons, man. We were so happy just to have gigs that we didn't question things when we should have. When I got on the plane, stepped onto the back and climbed up, Ronnie said, okay, we're all here, let's go. If Ronnie says go, then it's go. But Ronnie knew his destiny. He told me in Tokyo, Japan, that he would never live to see 30 and that he would go out with his boots on. Yeah, well, there's something there within that interview. And it's, we should never have taken off. We were morons, man. And I come back to my sort of earlier comment about every now and again getting in or not getting in a van with people, you know, and the pressure is on you because you've got to get from A to B, you've got to get to the gig. That's, you know, I mean, you're under a certain amount of pressure, especially if you've got a booking agent and promoters and there's some kind of money involved, and that if you don't show up, you obviously don't get paid, and oftentimes you'll get fined as well. And can you say as a reason, hey, listen, you know what? We felt that the driver wasn't up to scratch. I mean, how do you know that when you get into the plane? Well, this is the most boring, mundane reason. Cause one. Cause two is a bit more sexy. Drugs. I mean, it's not called sex, naps and rock and roll, is it? Or whatever you want to say. Something in sausage rolls. I don't know. I can't remember what the smart ass name for it all is. Drugs have always been part of the language of the touring musician, I guess. At least they were. Let's go as far back as the 1920s. I mean, you've all seen those episodes of the Peaky Blinders, right? And some people have said to me, were they all really taking cocaine back then? I mean, look, opium was a big drug in the late 20th century, the late 19th century. In Victorian societies, you had opium dens. Great opening track from the Moonspell album, Irreligious. But 1920s Berlin and Paris were hopping with cocaine and opium as the jazz rebellion and revolution swept across society. It became emblematic of being sort of rebellious music. And by all accounts, as the world tried to bounce back from World War One, there was a certain recklessness going on in society where people kind of, I think there was a kind of subconscious mood within society, a sort of, well, fuck it anyway. And we all almost went to hell, kind of did go to hell during the Great War. This next decade is going to be one of us trying to do everything we can to just get over that, to just forget it. And this sort of jazz rebellion, as I said, swept across society. And part of this was that between stages, between World War One and World War Two, and at least reading about it and reading about it from people there at the time, the society seemed to embrace a certain sort of, a lot of change after World War One. Of course, a lot of societal change, but a certain kind of recklessness, a little bit of fecklessness came into society. And, I mean, prostitution rose in cities across Europe, cities left ravaged by World War One as a means of survival for desperate women and sometimes men. Venereal diseases like syphilis and gonorrhea were spreading at a rate. What has this got to do with rock and roll, I hear you ask? Well, we're just talking about these cities embracing a certain decadent atmosphere, and there was certainly music attached to that. Berlin itself eventually acquired a reputation as a hub of drugs and drug dealing, cocaine, heroin, tranquilizers, amphetamines, and a big, big black market. At the time, the police identified up to 62 organized criminal gangs in Berlin. And also the German public, I guess, you know, in the media at the time, the newspapers, they also became fascinated with reports of homicides. The lust murders. There was also the underground book publishers. These are kind of inexpensive crime novels. They were called crimey, I guess. You know, it's just like film noir of the era. And there was all of this kind of this birth of psychosexual analysis. Basically, after World War One and into the 1920s, I mean, they don't call it the Roaring Twenties for nothing, but there became, they say there was an estimated 500 establishments, included a large number of homosexual venues for men and lesbians and transvestites and drugs everywhere. And music is booming and nightlife is booming. And it's very, it all has this sort of image of like incredible decadence. Artists in Berlin became fused with the city's underground culture, and there was cabaret and legitimate theater, and cocaine. And the same was happening in Paris. These cities, it kind of stands to reason, I suppose, in that a whole generation of people who wanted to try and forget the ravages of the First World War grew up amongst the ruins of World War One, and there was a sort of reaction to that. And if you've listened to my podcast, I think it was called Nazis on Speed, you'll be aware that during the coffee embargo in Germany post-World War One, amphetamine was taking over in the 1920s as well. Drug culture, there's no doubt, was part of the backdrop of this period. Jazz was seen as a sort of corrupting force in what was once civilized society, but the old order of the civilized society had already brought Europe to the brink and into this incredible war. And I think there's just a level of mistrust of all the institutions of state, and people were just turning to this decadent side. And of course, this was helped along with some good old fashioned post-empirical racist undertones. But those early jazz guys. And then you go into the, you know, the 30s and the 40s and 50s, it seemed like heroin. Heroin was also this incredibly, you know, this creative well from which to draw from. It hadn't quite embraced the sort of working class darkness that it became known for in the 1980s and the 1990s, especially growing up in Dublin. You saw that in the 80s everywhere. It kind of had a cool reputation, a kind of jazz reputation. I remember reading an interview about Megadeth and Gar Samuelson, who was a metal guy, but was into these jazz players, the old drummer of Megadeth who played on Peace Sells, and he died, I think, of heroin. And the attitude at the time was that it just seemed like a cool thing because of those jazz guys. And when it swung back into popularity in the late 60s across the West, across Western rock and roll, it claimed like many, many casualties, and has claimed, and no doubt will continue to claim casualties, even in the modern metal scene. And that might be fentanyl, I suppose, is the modern answer to that. Everyone thinks somehow they can defeat it, but it always wins. If you want to read any interview with Lemmy about the subject, you'll find he speaks very eloquently about it. He talks about his first girlfriend ever dying of heroin. And he just stuck to the powder back in those days, powder and acid. And he talks about how all the Hawkwind guys were on different drugs to him, uppers and downers. But that the ultimate downer, of course, that was heroin, and that people thought they could defeat it on a sort of romantic, artistic level. But once it had control, of course, it just defeated them. And whether it's Jim Morrison, Jimi Hendrix, Layne Staley, who I watched. I'm not a big Alice in Chains fan. Oddly enough, the one thing everybody loves about Alice in Chains is the thing I don't like, which is the sort of layered, harmonized vocals over backing everything, which is odd considering I like Dokken, who probably did something similar in the 1980s, oddly enough. But anyway, they were a dark band, and to some of the documentaries about his last couple of years are really, really dark. It just completely ravaged him. Janis Joplin, and on and on. And into the modern age under the guise of fentanyl. The heroin always had a sort of magical allure, it seems. And it seems to have defeated, you know, even the cleverest of us. Those who think, just the once and I could control it. Or I could just regulate it. I could, you know, just once a week or whatever it was. I've seen it, been offered it, smelt it, watched people sitting beside me, mong out, having taken it. But having grown up in Dublin in the 1980s, you saw clearly what it did to people. And you had a teenage friend or two who succumbed to it. Didn't look glamorous to me, but from my side, anything that didn't mean you couldn't talk up a storm or become more intense, I think it just seemed like a waste of time. So not for me, thank you very much. And everyone I saw who thought they could use it, it ended up using them. I think that's the best way to explain it, for the most part. So, despite, I suppose, heavy metal, black metal or dark, when you say dark metal's fascination with the likes of Aleister Crowley and considering its magical properties when it came to magic and occultism, a lot of people sort of kept that door closed. But it's not just musicians. I mean, obviously many creators, many writers, many actors, many painters thought they could get the better of it. It must be damn good. But like I said, you aren't having my Manowar collection on those terms. UFO, for example, one of my favourite bands when I was 9 or 10 or 11 was UFO. And once I met Pete Way after a gig in Dublin, UFO were brilliant. They hadn't played in years. It was like early 2000s and I was DJing after the gig. And I brought all my old UFO records for him to sign. And I saw him rushing out the front door in a fur coat and still his, you know, gig clothes. And I went up to him. And he was obviously just absolutely monged out of his head. And he just was like, I told him, oh, my uncle got me into UFO, blah, blah. Wet hair, lank hair hanging down. Hugged me. You tell you fucking uncle, he's a fucking legend. And then wouldn't let me go and goofed off on my shoulder. Separated again by the bouncer. I've tried to get him to sign my records. He just held the pen and just scribbled in a big line. Eventually wrote his name on all of them. And I was just sort of, you know, just staring at him. And he had a big bouncer with him and some girl with him. And he just grabbed me again and blah, 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 in my ear. And eventually they kind of pulled him off me, which sounds very odd, and walked him away. And I came back in and Dara from Invictus was there. And he goes, oh, did you meet Pete Way? Who'd been like, you know, I mean, let's be honest. Steve Harris modelled his look and everything on Pete Way, the same stripy pants. They used Dr. Docker as the intro. I said, how was he? I goes, well, now there's a story. And apparently UFO, those guys were with Bon Scott the night he died. And they'd been doing the BH for decades and decades. Look at Johnny Thunders. You can watch that Johnny Thunders YouTube. There's a really dark footage of some gig in, I think, in Paris or something, of Johnny Thunders' band and them all, like, strung out in the backstage beforehand, and there's fighting going on, all sorts of stuff. Dark things. Well, what do you think the song Chinese Rocks is about? Oddly enough, Townes Van Zandt, in my opinion, the greatest country and western songwriter. Cocaine Blues just popped up in my random listening tastes on Spotify the other night. And that's been part of the musician's backstory for many, many years. It's not usually, amphetamine, I guess, is not usually the source of overdoses. But we've all heard those stories. I think, what's his name, singer of Quiet Riot, died that way. Probably have been living the same way for 40 years, a bit older. The body is a bit more worn down, racks up a line, and dies literally choking the pool cue in his somebody's house in the afternoon. You could see it, you know, California sun streaming in, going to be a few games of pool on Saturday night, and you're just doing the same thing you've always been doing for 30, 40 years. But this time, your heart and your body can't take it, and you clock out. This gets quite a lot of musicians over the years. the stories of Van Halen, the stories of many, many rock bands in the 70s and 80s are just punctuated with this. But it seems that something is changing now, because speaking to some of my friends in America, they're saying that, I mean, you know that the greatest killer in North America every single year is people overdosing from prescription drugs, and that everyone is just worried about fentanyl. And just, you know, buying something off someone, everyone is desperate. Well, they're desperately worried about the fact that it could be laced with something a bit more extreme. So, and of course, some sort of fentanyl derivative was partly responsible for Dolores O'Riordan, for Prince, for Tom Petty. And yeah, I just keep mentioning names and, you know, you keep going, oh yeah, God, they died as well. The list is endless, and there seems to be more to this, as I said, than meets the eye. When I was, you know, sort of making some notes about this podcast, about why musicians die younger, and I said it to my friend, and he said, oh, is that really true? And then once I sort of, between us then, we listed about 50, 60, 70 names. I mean, it's no good having a podcast where you just list endless names, but after it, he just went, fucking hell, yeah, that's a lot of famous people within, or not, and not some famous people who've just clocked out early and clocked out. You know, Whitney Houston, yeah, there you go. But fentanyl has changed the game, huh? And it looks like those Chinese chemists are closing another rock and roll avenue, huh? No wonder the hip hop guys drink cough medicine, right? Isn't that what they drink? Benadryl, something or other, and they mix this with energy drinks or something. At least that's what I read. How would I know what youth culture is or what young people are doing? I wouldn't. I only hear third and fourth hand rumors. But there's absolutely no doubt that being in a band opens this door. Well, unless you're probably a power metal band. But I've been on tours where there's been dealers or someone holding something at almost every show somewhere, or you hear a rumor about it. And of course, people who have this or that, they want the story. They want the story of doing whatever drug with whatever rock star, or, you know, doing a line with someone famous or whatever moment they can share with people. And I've seen people, and I always think this is a terrible thing, bringing big bottles of booze as gifts to people from bands. If you're thinking about doing that, don't do that. Especially if you've heard that the person you're giving it to has a problem with alcohol. That's kind of, and I've seen this myself with musicians I know are struggling and trying to get a handle on it, and somebody brings them like a gift of a huge bottle of Ouzo. Don't do that. And bring them something cool, bring them something nice if you really want to do it, like some sort of present or gift, or I don't know, maybe buy them a shot maybe, but don't bring them a huge bottle of something if you know they're struggling. And I've seen, I'm not going to mention names, but I've seen said musician then play an absolutely terrible show 2 or 3 hours later because they've just been unable to resist the temptation of cracking open that bottle. I've seen it, and it's, you know, it's a hard one to avoid. I mean, I've said this probably before on the podcast, but one of the times when I stopped drinking whiskey, maybe 2010, 2011, playing in Finland with Absu, and drum roadie put a bottle of Jim Beam on the drum riser. We'd been playing a long gig, like 2 hour 20, 30, after about 2 hours, and I tell no joke, I drank that entire bottle straight in about 4, 5, 6 goes straight, like some dickhead thing to do, like as if I was pretending to be a Motley Crue in 1986. And the whole night was just an insane journey of being a dickhead, starting fights, losing things, smashing things, breaking stuff. And the next day, Kieran just said, if you, this band is this, you don't sing the coffin ships and then leap into the crowd to hit somebody. And this is just not the band for doing that. And if it keeps happening, well, that'll be the end of it. And it was like a big slap in the face, a big wake-up call, and yeah, he was totally right. But some people, this gets them. This gets them somewhere, you know? As in, they don't pull back from the brink. And of course, I still like a drink, but I replaced heavy, heavy booze with just a liking for red wine, and that just dialed the volume back on me to a reasonable level that other people could deal with. But what happens Is that people just get tired of drinking, or else they need something else to enable them to drink more, and that's where you end up mixing everything together. Wine is fine, but whiskey's quicker, my friends. Powder enables them both, but there's no doubt if you overindulge, it will come back to you in later life. It has to, as your body is breaking down, as you're getting slower. We're all aging, and maybe people do underestimate the healing power of the body and how much you can put up with, which is quite incredible. But at the same time, eventually it starts to break down. And habits are habits. Like I said, Kevin Dubrow, Quiet Riot. That's the name I'd forgotten earlier. You're pretty sure, you know, he died from a heart attack. I think it must have been 58, 57, 56, and was probably just doing the same thing he'd been doing when he was 26 and 36 and 46. And eventually it caught up with you. Even our Lemmy Who Art on High, eventually it caught up with his body. And there's a couple of those gigs you've probably seen in the last couple of years were hard to watch. But I admire he went out on his own terms, and he went out fighting. He went out on stage. He went, you know, fuck you to the big C. But certainly his body, you know, he was dealing with pain from diabetes, from all sorts of other things. I guess it also depends what you've done with your money. Maybe at least the old rock stars, we don't have to worry about that now in bands, but the old rock stars did. I look at David Coverdale. There's interviews I saw in the early 90s on Monsters of Rock, and it's clear he's making references to the old Peruvian marching powder throughout the interview. And if you were clever with your money, you're always going to have enough money for that. But there's plenty of people who squandered all of that money. But it's a game. It's a game. And you never know if that next line is going to be the one that explodes your heart. Or maybe you've got some congenitive heart disease. Oh, God, that's so terribly un-rock and roll. But it's a game. And you've got to play the game carefully. There's a certain no doubt it will shorten your life. There has to come a time, I suppose, when you stop. I know you still can't have my Man of War records. Balance and hydration, my friends. And all of this abuse, of course, what can it do for the onset of other diseases? Who know? Alzheimer's, cancers, even possibly. But then, so can lots of other things. There's also, I think, being in a band cultivates a cult of irresponsibility. The cliche of the band guy lives on as a man-child well into middle age. Those few festivals can pay the bills for that month or two, so you don't need to get up on the Monday morning. And look, I get it. If you're working down a mine or offshore drilling on an oil rig, I've no doubt your percentage of dying young is also pretty high. But I would wager being a tour musician can go almost toe-to-toe with some of these, or at least it could. Like I said, I think that our definition of excess has changed, and our celebration of excess is not the same anymore. I look at someone like Shane McGowan, and I saw Shane McGowan play gigs. Literally, he broke his hip or his leg, and he got into a wheelchair 10, 12, 14 years ago, and he sort of seemed to stay in it. And I'd seen great Shane McGowan gigs and ones where he could barely do a thing at all. And Irish people celebrated it because we celebrated it in our Celtic way, that kind of cult of heroic failure. And I don't mean that in a musical sense, because, of course, Shane McGowan wrote incredible music and incredible lyrics. But people seeing as it's St. Patrick's Day, I suppose, as a story in it, but people seem to love seeing him absolutely fucked up. And I think our relationship to excess has changed. I don't think young people, at least the young people that I know in their teenage years, they don't celebrate or venerate these kind of things. There used to be this thing in Kerrang! Magazine, and it was called Your Round or something, and it was always just, they took out some musicians to a bar, and then it just showed how much booze they their bill at the end of it. And it was supposed to be kind of celebrated if the bill was insane. 12 shots of whiskey and blah, blah, blah. All that stuff is gone from the likes of Kerrang! And has been gone for years. It's just not celebrated anymore. And I feel kind of, you know, I feel, on the one hand, when it comes to people's health and all that kind of thing, that that's probably positive. But at the same time, rock and roll without the rock and roll, that's the problem. You need some small whiff of brimstone to make it real rock and roll, which is one of the reasons why there aren't any really big rock and roll bands anymore, or rock isn't popular anymore. Because I just think the things that appeal to young people, this is just so antiquated, so old-fashioned. And of course, the fact that everybody films everything. This means that misbehaving or behaving irresponsibly has way more repercussions than it used to. And the sex bit, well, I guess AIDS claimed its share of musicians, Freddie Mercury, George Michael, right? I should also mention, if you have never watched George Michael singing for Queen in the rehearsals, up to the Freddie Mercury tribute, oh, watch that. There's a man who could sing. My God. My God, George Michael could sing. He could have absolutely killed in a heavy metal band. Absolutely killed it. Anyway, Robin Crosby, Rat. There's lots of other people. I have a note here which says, mention Fauci and AIDS. Anything to get the boot in. You can do that. You can search those two things. Fauci, AIDS, 1980s, and you'll find your own story. But thankfully, this door has been more or less closed and certainly had its time. Suicide. I was there. I was remember being at a gig the day Kurt Cobain killed himself. And I remember seeing it came up on MTV on the television. And he was just the end, another an endless line of people, musicians who'd done the same thing. But there has to be a day, I suppose, where you simply go clean and give it all up. As there seems something semi-tragic about being the 60, 65-year-old rock star dressing like a 25-year-old and chasing experiences half his or her age, still hoovering up lines and drinking whiskey at the end of the bar. Well, I'll tell you how it is if the podcast is in another 10 or 15 years. But I have to say, maybe go out on your own terms. And perhaps this is the way to go rather than standing... rather than ending up in a hospice somewhere at 78 waiting round to die, as Towns Van Zandt would have put it. Maybe the myth of leaving a beautiful corpse has its virtues. Certainly in the case of Towns, maybe remembering him from heart-worn highways is best. Or remembering Rory Gallagher from his live shows that are some of the most incredible things ever on YouTube from the mid to late 70s to the 80s, then remembering him at the end, or remembering Phil Innett in his total pomp, his best, rather than the last shows. And leaving the myth of rock and roll, or rather country, or whatever you want to call it, intact. Because it's for sure Johnny Cash and Little Richard and all those guys, they wouldn't have had it any other way. So what's the conclusion? The conclusion is, I think that the chances of dying young, if you were a heavily touring musician like back in the day, I think are probably pretty high. But it's a trade-off. You sold your soul to the devil and all that kind of stuff. He's going to want maybe you to get down there a little bit earlier than expected. And can you really do the rock and roll without rock and roll? I would say not. So, balance and stay hydrated, my friends. Until next time, happy St. Patrick's Day and all that kind of thing.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.